Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Norper, a Professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and an Associate at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum, CSIS, at Columbia University. A former State Department Senior Analyst, he held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Norper.
Thank you, Ian.
So what do you make of this sudden change in the summit or the possibility of a summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, which seemed to be sort of, nobody was taking it that seriously, but then Kim Jong-un makes a secret trip to meet with Xi Jinping in China, and basically they say the deal's on, and Donald Trump is already very optimistic and keen to start. So the question I would have for you, first of all, Stephen, is this deal was first brought to the White House by the South Koreans, and now it looks like it's going to be brokered by the Chinese, or at the very least the Chinese have given it a huge impetus. So what is the U.S. role?
Well, I think I would maybe have a slightly different view in that I still see South Korea as the primary driver. I think it's an important step, and I look at it rather optimistically, because what it means is that the North Koreans are willing to put their credibility on the line by upping the ante, by bringing in the Chinese, and on the one sense looking for Chinese guarantees or backing, but on the other hand also saying to Beijing that they see them as a critical part of the process. That's actually a good thing in terms of U.S. role, because Washington has been very determined in terms of trying to make much of the maximum pressure campaign about Chinese co-sponsorship of resolutions in the U.N., as well as support on the imposition of sanctions. And those seem to have had some bite. So Washington seems to be determined, and as you mentioned, Trump seems to be signaling that at this point it's a go-ahead. And Kim Jong-un is certainly being more committal publicly by way of this Chinese visit. And the Chinese, no doubt, relish their role because they probably would have felt overlooked otherwise and see an important diplomatic contribution that is probably in keeping with what the Americans and international community have expected of them on the sanctions front. All of this, though, all of this goes back to Moon Jae-in in South Korea and a very calculated strategy to bring in the international players in support of Seoul's policy toward Pyongyang.
Well, we don't know what the Japanese position is, do we? And Abe is visiting Washington to go to Mar-a-Lago to meet with President Trump after he gets back from a South American trip in April. So have you heard anything from the Japanese?
I have. I've had some discussions, but I think that the way to look at it is, you know, with the full expectation that Japan and the Abe visit will concentrate on maintaining maximum pressure. They don't want to see any softening of that policy. In fact, they would like to see a step up and inclusion of the issue of abductees. So no doubt they will say this again to Trump, who did mention abductees in the course of some of his prior statements ahead of and during the U.S. presidential visit to Northeast Asia in November of last year. So I think one can assume that the Japanese have, along with the United States, the hardest of lines on this, whereas Russia, China, and South Korea have been pushing more progressively in the way of negotiation. And so expect a harder line message coming out of that meeting. But that's all part and parcel of the process. So Kim Jong-un going to Beijing, meeting with Xi Jinping is one part of the process. Abe communicating to Trump is another. Remember, there's an all-important inter-Korean meeting, a third presidential summit, meeting the two progressive administrations of Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun in the early 2000s, and now with President Moon Jae-in, and that will be a historic meeting. Moon will then meet with Trump, ostensibly, and then Trump, if all things continue, has committed on this path to meeting with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. So it's a very complex and, at this point, very rapid set of developments.
In terms of their rapid advancement in nuclear testing and missile development, apparently the overheads, the satellites, have picked up a new nuclear reactor. It's estimated that it could produce 20 kilograms of plutonium per year. So apparently Kim gave Xi Jinping some assurances that they would denuclearize. So what does that mean to you?
Well, it means a couple of things. One is that we shouldn't be naive in this process. There is every real reason to believe that they're continuing on their path of missile and nuclear development, and that is a foremost concern, both in terms of what they have and the immediate potential by way of the lethality of improved nuclear and missile capability, but also in terms of concerns about proliferation and concerns about the challenge to the broader non-proliferation regime, what it says to other countries about the path of nuclear development. So it is paramount to try to curtail that. What has been said after the Beijing meeting is that there was a commitment by Kim Jong-un to denuclearize to the Chinese. And one doesn't know about the accuracy of that completely, but if there was some sort of statement in that regard, keep in mind that both his father, Kim Jong-il, and grandfather, Kim Il-sung, made similar commitments about not developing nuclear capability and about the importance of a nuclear weapons-free Korea Peninsula. So it may be seen a bit different through the North Korean lens. So trying to find a way to stem that is of critical importance. That's why negotiation is so important. And remember, the path we were on before the Olympic moment, which may have turned into an Olympic movement towards peaceful negotiation on this issue, is one of confrontation. And the cost there would be severe. So de-escalating the crisis is critically important. And that's why all of these different portions of trying to secure a negotiation process that works by the time that Trump and Kim Jong-un sit down, should it occur, is so very critical.
Well, the North Korean official news agency, KCNA, made no mention of Kim's pledge to Xi Jinping to denuclearize, or did they discuss the anticipated meeting with Trump? But you were a senior analyst in the State Department, Stephen Norper, and the State Department has been hollowed out. The NSC has been hollowed out in terms of its Korea expertise. The top official has quit recently. So who's doing the groundwork? Who's doing laying the diplomatic groundwork here? My understanding is that it's Mike Pompeo over at the CIA has a team working the back channels to set up this summit.
Mm-hmm. So there is an interagency process, and it's basically left to Pompeo's team, which one would assume is incoming in his role of Secretary of State, and then also those on the National Security Council, the Senior Director for Asia at the NSC, and his assistant on the issue. But you're right to point out that there's a capacity issue, and there's a problem that even predates this of many of the first-generation Korea analysts having retired from government or moved on, and that's just stepped up with the hollowing out, as you describe it, of the State Department. So there is a real need for expertise, and there's a need for advisory. It's important that we really be considering the full range of plans, backups, contingencies, and we'll see how that goes. Now, counter to that, you're dealing with a transactional president who seems to feel that he can strike the deal and that doesn't necessarily entail the traditional manner of negotiations where you would have senior advisors and diplomats working to groom a process where you might ultimately have the heads of state meet. So this is almost in reverse, where you would have a senior most level meeting, perhaps putting a negotiation process into play and leaving the details to those who are active in government and would have to carry that out. But do we need more talent in on the North Korea issue? Certainly. That's really paramount. Not having an ambassador in place in Seoul is a critical deficit. And so trying to shore up our capabilities, especially with 2 short months remaining before a dialogue like this would take place is something to keep in mind.
But is it concerning that Donald Trump may be more prone to making a deal that makes him look good as opposed to being in America's interest? Because we know he is quite narcissistic, to put it bluntly, and he's also mercurial. So you really, given who your principal is in these summit meetings, if you're staffing this up, you'd want some real heft in that staff work, wouldn't you, to make sure that he wasn't flattered like he was by Xi Jinping on, remember, that recent trip to China?
You would hope there would be more of a team in place, and it's a bit surprising to see both the step down of Tillerson and McMaster. And in their place, you have Pompeo and John Bolton. Bolton certainly is seen as the hardest line player to have entered the scene. And that means that the chances for success on a negotiation could go down, because he thinks that basically the U.S. president should demand the immediate removal of weaponry, and anything short of that, that there shouldn't be any give and take to the process. And he's written on that quite publicly and made public statements to that effect. So how closely will Donald Trump listen to the new national security advisor on this? Will that somehow lessen the desire to strike at a deal? But clearly he feels that he'll be able to make a difference where his predecessors haven't. And as you point out, that may be a narcissistic tendency, but remember, ultimately, he will declare whether that meeting with Kim Jong-un has been a success or not. And the South Koreans are watching very, very cautiously and trying to manage a process where you're dealing with two very large personalities in both Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, who are less predictable and more belligerent in tone. And that's very hard for U.S. government professionals. It's very hard for South Korean diplomats in the South Korean administration. But all of this, in terms of moving through a process of some dialogue, again, is much better than the alternative, which was the move towards a military strike. And we may be back at that at some point. Part of the danger of this process is that it raises the level to such a degree, because you're dealing with the U.S. president and that imprimatur, and the meeting with the North Korean leader, that if this does fail, then the alternative is most likely military conflict. It puts things at a seriously high level that can lead to conflict.
Well, nobody wants to be a killjoy, and in an ironic way, that may well be a major impetus. In other words, what's waiting in the wings here is if Kim comes back empty-handed, even though he controls the minds of the people through massive and ubiquitous propaganda, he still may feel the need to overcome the fact that he's got a black eye and to strike out. And then on our side, you've got the incoming hawks, hardliners like Pompeo and in particular John Bolton. So the message there is the U.S. position is going to harden, not soften. So this might well work to get both sides focused, right? I can't figure out what's happening on the North Korean side, and I think most people can't. But what do you
think? Right, and no one really knows how Kim Jong-un would be able to continue his appeal, which has had so much emphasis on the nuclear and missile development in the early stages of his Pyongyang or two-track policy, which is nuclear weapons development and then economic modernization. Perhaps he's moving on to economic modernization. But in terms of Trump, I've mentioned, you know, most of us try to realize and accept the transactional aspect of this president, but he sees himself as also a transitional president. And he wants to be seen as Reagan-esque. If you take a look at John Bolton's last piece from 2 weeks ago, he writes about a lineage of Roosevelt to Reagan. And I'm certain that's what he'll convey to the president. And so the president will want to see himself transitional in that way. So stranger things have happened. And sometimes in the history of U.S. foreign policy, clearly the Beijing opening is what comes to mind first, that it's Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon who opened the door with China. And there may be then a desire by Donald Trump Trump to make this his China-Nixon moment.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Norpa, it's always seemed that there's really no military solution to this, particularly with the citizens of Seoul being held hostage to any escalation, either through conventional war or even nuclear war. So at the end of the day, my understanding has always been that the best way to bring down the Kim regime, it's a despicable gangster family, a kleptocracy. Mm-hmm. What they do is just so horrible to their own people. So the idea that if Kim comes off on the, as a now as a legitimate member on the world stage, then forget about the North Korean people have mm-hmm. lives improving. And my sense has always been that that's the Kim's Achilles heel. I mean, he's more afraid of his own people getting soap operas from South Korea than mm-hmm. anything else, because that breaks through the hermetic seal of delusion and cradle-to-grave propaganda. So what's your sense there? That would that be the final irony, that this deal would seal the fate of the North Korean people as opposed to lead them on a path towards being liberated and able to breathe the free air as most of the planet does?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you make several good points, and I think the the fact of the matter is he has to deal with a regime that has now quite lethal nuclear capability and the ability to deliver that via intercontinental ballistic missiles. And by Pompeo's account, they're near there, right? His latest statement, again, has been a matter of months in terms of perfecting some of that ICBM technology. So trying to find an immediate way to stem that is all important. But you're right about the more problematic and endemic aspect of the process, that you have an illegitimate regime that controls its people, that is guilty of gross human rights abuses, that has 130,000 imprisoned in gulag-type labor camps, crimes that the 2014 United Nations Commission of Inquiry report labeled as Nazi-era atrocities. And you've seen mention of this at the State of Union address and the testimonial of North Korean defectors. So on top of concern about nuclear and missile, chemical weapons and human rights, you have some very, very difficult aspects. But in that sense, looking to Seoul for a managed process that deals effectively with integration and ultimately unification is really important. And trying to find ways to employ a 70-year-old ROK U.S. alliance that was born in blood from the Korean War and that brings in international actors in effective and constructive ways is important. And ultimately, then, the fate of the North Korean regime may be that of those countries who disappeared in 1989 when we saw the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And one can't help but think that they may go the page of history. Remember, in 1979, South Korea's president at the time, Park Chung-hee, was assassinated over dinner by his intelligence chief. So the chance of palace coups and intrigues, it's all within range of possibility, even if not probability. And so the young leader may be acting based on economic pragmatism or feeling the bite of sanctions or wanting to stem dissent within his own political environment that we may not even know of or that may be even at lowest levels. But as you point out, information sets people free, and information is already cracking North Korean society. And the more that North Koreans learn of the advances of their brethren to the south, of the disparities of their condition, their desire for freedom can only grow.
Well, Stephen Norpa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Norpa, who's a professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum, CSIS, at Columbia University. A former State Department senior analyst, he held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.